It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. As of this morning, same-sex marriage is legal in all 50 states. The Supreme Court today delivered an historic victory for gay rights, ruling 5-4 that the Constitution requires that same-sex couples be allowed to marry regardless of where they live, and that states may no longer reserve the right to marry for heterosexual couples only. Joining us to look at the impact of today's ruling is University of Pittsburgh Professor of Law Anthony Infante. Anthony Infante, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a comment or question about today's Supreme Court ruling, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at ESSPGH. We'd like to hear from you whether you are in favor or against this decision and how it impacts your life. Anthony Infante, there are different ways that the decision could have gone, and we'll get into some of that. But what were you expecting to hear this morning, and were you at all surprised by this decision?
I wasn't sure what we were going to hear. So, I mean, it was going to be a surprise no matter what. I was a little bit surprised at how far they actually went. I mean, that they basically just said, okay, gay marriage is going to be legal in all 50 states. You know, every state has to recognize same-sex marriage, and every state has to recognize same-sex marriages from other states.
Why did that surprise you?
Because they could have gone not quite so far. And there was some talk about that after the arguments, especially because, you know, Justice Kennedy was viewed as the linchpin here, kind of the deciding vote. And he was talking a lot about federalism in those arguments. And, you know, some people were thinking there he might try to strike a balance, you know, by trying to respect the state's rights to define marriage while at the same time respecting the dignity of same-sex couples and seeing if maybe there was, because there were two questions that the court was deciding. Does each state have to allow same-sex couples to marry? And if not, do they have to recognize marriages from outside of the state? And so there was some question about whether they might not answer the first question no and the second question yes, to try to balance things. And they didn't. They answered both questions yes.
And really, I mean, if you look at the Constitution, regardless of how you feel about gay marriage, constitutionally, when you look at the decision, and it's going to take some time to read through all of it, and I know you've read through the majority opinion.
I read through the majority opinion, started skimming the dissents because it's over 100 pages long total.
And by the way, Justice Roberts was one of the dissenters.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, it was 5-4. So Justice Roberts dissented, Alito, Scalia, and I'm forgetting somebody, Thomas, all dissented.
Right. No surprise there.
There's no surprise there.
But when you look at the Constitution, if you interpret it correctly, is there any other conclusion that can be arrived at?
Well, obviously, people have differing opinions, which is why this ended up at the Supreme Court. And you even had one. I mean, the reason why it ended up at the Supreme Court is you had a circuit court of appeals, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, disagreeing with the result the Supreme Court actually came out with. I mean, part of what's going on here is they're deciding this under the due process and equal protection clauses, which are very short. They're very succinct. And it's really up to the court to fill in what those things mean. You know, what does equal protection mean? And as the court acknowledges in the majority opinion, especially equal protection, that evolves over time as to what we think is unequal treatment of people.
Right, right. The perception of it does. I'm not sure if the law does, but the Supreme Court's action is in conjunction with a sharp change in public opinion about gay marriage, which most of the country now favors. And the justices of the Supreme Court are supposed to make a strict interpretation of what the Constitution states. But if that were the case, today's ruling in favor of gay marriage would have happened years ago. How much of an impact does the court of public opinion have on a case like this? I know these justices are supposed to be in some sort of a vacuum and ignoring what's being said on the streets, but some of that has to have seeped into those chambers.
Oh, I mean, I definitely think that the court of public opinion, that public opinion about what's happening in society matters in these types of cases because we are filling things in. Because if you think about what would be a strict, quote unquote, strict interpretation of the Constitution, some people would say, well, go back to, you know, 200 years ago and see what they would have said. And, you know, the answer would have been very different than the answer that we got today in terms of, you know, whether same-sex couples would marry. Back then, same-sex relations were illegal. And so, you know, what happens over time, public opinion over time clearly has an impact on, you know, kind of what we as a society think equal protection means and what due process means. And that's, you know, and what fundamental rights are, because this is what the due process part of it was about today, is what's a fundamental right. And that kind of thing, it does evolve over time. And clearly the court, you know, at some level takes into account and thinks about kind of where the country is at and where the country is willing to go. Is that I don't think they want to get too far ahead of the country either.
So that's what it is. It's that someone might look at this and say, you know, when you look at phrases like the pursuit of happiness or, you know, the rights of man, which is how it would have been phrased 200 years ago.
But in the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
Yeah.
When you look at that, if you know, it would have been a conclusion that a legal scholar would say, I don't know how we cannot arrive at this. At the same time, you're saying that you kind of wait, the court waits for the public to kind of come around to some sort of point of view that ultimately impacts this.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're seeing to a certain extent, you know, the court reflecting what's happening in society. I mean, because even in the majority opinion, they talk some about how marriage has changed over time. You know, that marriage has gone from, you know, being an institution where, you know, it was the parents arranging marriages for political or other reasons, to marriage being a voluntary contract, but the woman being subject to the man by law. That, you know, basically it was called the law of coverture, that the woman just became part of the husband and subsumed in the husband. And then in the 20th century, we moved away from that. And then we saw the Supreme Court striking down laws that discriminated on the basis of gender in the context of marriage. And then now you're seeing them, you know, taking yet another step and saying, well, OK, you know, you can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation in marriage either. So, I mean, those are things that, you know, 200 years ago, there would have been no question but that they discriminated against women. It's society evolving over time and them reflecting that evolution. And now we're seeing the same thing with sexual orientation. Society's evolved. Society's different. And the same goes with race. I mean, you know, this is a country that has a long history of slavery and dealing with slavery. And now you see things
and mixed marriages were not allowed.
Mixed marriages, that was not, and the court relies on that opinion as well. That was from 1967. So, you know, that's not that long ago that they struck down the last bans on interracial marriage. And so that's reflecting to a certain extent the evolution in mores in the society.
So not to go all 60s on you, but this is what what today's decision reflects in part is the power of the people.
I think so. I mean, I think in part it does reflect that. I think that's in part how we've come so far so fast. I mean, because if you think about it, so when I was graduating from high school is when the Supreme Court decided Bowers v. Hardwick. Okay. That was the year that they said that they could throw me in jail for being gay. And that's perfectly fine. And now you're talking, you know, what, it's 30, not quite 30 years later, they're saying that it's I can get married in every state. And it's only 10 years ago that they said that they threw out the last of the criminal bans on same-sex sexual practices. So, I mean, you're seeing things move very quickly in that regard. I mean, you know, 2003 was when Lawrence v. Texas came down, the one that struck down the sodomy bans. And we're talking 2015, just 12 years later, you're striking down all the last of the same-sex marriage bans in the states.
Right. All these laws were on the books in, mm-hmm. you know, in an historical context, what is fairly recently, and probably would surprise a lot of people. 412-246-2002 to join the conversation. We're talking with University of Pittsburgh law professor Anthony Infante. And we want to hear from you. We want to hear your opinions about this decision, what it means to you, how it impacts your life. And we are welcome to hearing from any and all sides on this. 412-246-2002 is the number to call. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at ESSPGH. One way that this decision could have gone would have been to defer or leave the decision in the hands of individual states while requiring mm-hmm. states where gay marriage was not legal to recognize the legality of marriages made in states where gay marriage was legal. And this wouldn't have really satisfied anybody, would it? It in some ways, people saw this as this may be the compromise. Mm-hmm. If the Supreme Court doesn't want to go too far in one direction or the other, they will compromise in this way. But ultimately, it's a compromise, as with so many other compromises, that doesn't, at the end of the day, doesn't satisfy anyone.
Right, right. It would have been a compromise. It doesn't satisfy everyone, and it would have made people's lives miserable, is what it comes down to. I mean, it's, you know, it's all, it was already difficult under the regime that we had. But if you're talking about, okay, you don't, a state can prohibit you from getting married, but you, if you're married in another state and come to that state, then they would have to recognize your marriage. Well, the state that you live in is not happy, and they're also, in essence, then, you know, treating their own citizens worse than they're treating people who are coming from outside of the state. And then you get into questions of, well, what about the people who live in the state who then travel across the border to get married and come back? You know, it would have been an open question about how the Supreme Court dealt with that. Would, you know, would you have complete control over the people in your state and be able to deny the recognition of those marriages? Or would you have to recognize those? And then do you create an economic division? Because, okay, if you would have to recognize those, you know, marriages when people just cross the border and come back, well, if you're, if you live near a state that has same-sex marriage and, you know, you're wealthy enough to be able to cross the border and get married and come back, then you're okay. But, you know, if you're too poor to do all of that, then, you know, you're out of luck. It would have raised all sorts of crazy, horrible issues. So this is actually much cleaner in the way of a decision.
Should someone like Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane be given credit for being ahead of the curve here and coming to the conclusion over a year ago that for this state, to do anything less than recognizing same-sex marriages would be unconstitutional?
Well, I mean, you know, if you give her credit, you have to give lots of other people credit who were ahead
right,
of the curve
just,
in arguing
in
that this was unconstitutional.
We're in Pennsylvania, and, yeah. and this is a state that, you know, decided over a year ago that we're not going to enforce a ban on same-sex marriage anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because, you know, whether, again, whether you agree with her or not, the attorney general came out and said, "I, you know, looking at this as a constitutional issue, I don't see how we can deny mm-hmm. this, what amounts to a fundamental right."
Right. I mean, we also had legislature saying the same thing. In essence, you know, even at a certain level, Governor Corbett was saying the same thing. He didn't agree with it, but he was, you know, he gave up the appeal because he said he didn't think it was going to be successful. That was in essence, a legal judgment. He may not agree with it, but it was a legal judgment that it was not going to be successful on appeal.
And Attorney General Kathleen Kane has released a statement today. Quoting from her statement, she says, quote, "Today's landmark Supreme Court decision affirming the legality of same-sex marriage is a victory not only for same-sex couples, their families and children, but affirms the rights of all citizens for equal treatment under the law." And critics of the decision say that the courts have sent the country into uncharted territory by changing the traditional definition of marriage. What is important for these opponents to realize and take into account on this historic day?
Well, I mean, it would be uncharted territory if not one single state had had same-sex marriage before June 26, 2015. I mean, Massachusetts has had same-sex marriage since 2004.
Yeah.
And so the sky has not fallen in Massachusetts. The sky has not fallen in Pennsylvania in the past 13 months. You know, none of that has occurred. So, I mean, to really call it uncharted territory, I think is wrong.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with our guest, Pitt Law Professor Anthony Infante. We're talking about today's Supreme Court decision, the historic decision, a 5-4 ruling that same-sex marriage is legal in all 50 states. Let's go to Joe on a cell phone. Joe, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, sir.
I just made a comment. I heard what the professor said about the court reading the tea leaves, if you will, of the society, and obviously that's what they have done. And you know, it doesn't impact my life one bit because neither I'm not a gay nor do I really think that I think they have an absolute right to do it. People have a right to do what they want to do, and if that's what two consenting adults want to do, that's wonderful. But you know, if you look back at the way the court has acted over the years, miscegenation laws were in effect some years ago, where interracial marriages were prohibited, and the court read that has obviously changed that. The racial segregation, if we go back to what the founders wrote and think about what it was at that time, we'd still have segregation. We probably still would be saying school prayers and things like that. You know, I think the court has to listen to public opinion, because public opinion is going to eventually take over one way or the other. And I think they've done that. I think he's absolutely right. And they can, a court has to fill in these gaps, if you will, that the Constitution is not doesn't have any great specificity to, such as the due process clause and the equal protection clause. So it just seems like the right thing to do.
Well, Joe, we appreciate that. And what about what Joe is saying, Anthony?
I think he's, you know, right in the sense that, you know, the court is having to fill in the gaps there. I mean, that's, you know, you have a constitution that's written very succinctly. It's not very long, and they use some very nice phrases, but phrases that are not very precise. They're and likely on purpose, so that way things could evolve over time.
What does this say about the Constitution, though, that while these, you know, what happened today, what was decided today might not have been, probably was not specifically envisioned by our founding fathers, that it allows for the evolution of society. It allows for, there's room, enough room for interpretation that as society evolves, we make allowances for what people see as equal rights. What might not have been equal rights or seen as such over 200 years ago is now seen today as a fundamental right.
Right.
And it's the Constitution that has opened the door for that, right?
Right. I mean, I think that's the great strength of the Constitution is the way that it was written. It wasn't written the way, because I'm a lawyer, it's not written the way that lawyers write laws, which tend to be very, very specific and try to get at everything. You know, they were more general, they were broader, announcing general principles, principles that then could evolve with the way society was evolving and adapt to the society that we were having and that we want to have.
412-246-2002 is the number to call. And one question that I'll throw out there to people is that, and we've heard this from people who have been opposed to gay marriage. There's a concern. There has been a concern, and I say this with full respect for these concerns, that there has been for many people this idea that if we allow gay marriage, it somehow compromises or adversely impacts the sanctity of marriage, of the institution of marriage as it has traditionally been known. And I guess what I would like to hear from people is, how do you feel this impacts your marriage now that gay marriage is legal? Has anything changed? Has the earth moved? Or do you feel that in some way that for you this is a problem? And we'd like to hear your explanation as to why. 412-246-2002 is the number to call. I wanted to get into some other statements that people have made today, or that and organizations have made as well, like the ACLU of Pennsylvania. They issued a statement on today's marriage equality decision. The statement said, quote, "This is an historic and joyous occasion. We know from our experience here in Pennsylvania that no one is hurt when people are allowed to marry the person he or she loves. We should all be proud of this victory for equality, freedom, and love," end quote. And again, there are those who might disagree with that, but those are the sentiments of the ACLU, which has certainly fought for this. And Governor Wolf issued a statement today regarding the Supreme Court's same-sex marriage ruling, saying that, quote, "Today the Supreme Court affirmed that no American can be denied the right to marry because of who they love. This historic ruling is a victory for the LGBTQ Pennsylvanians and allies. Gay marriage is now simply marriage, and the pursuit of happiness will no longer be denied for same-sex couples." Now, what I wanted to point to here, Anthony, is also what the governor goes on to say, which is that on the heels of the Supreme Court's action today, the Pennsylvania legislature should stand up and pass non-discrimination for LGBTQ Pennsylvanians so that they can no longer be discriminated against in employment or housing for being who they are. Anthony Infante, is this the next logical step in the process?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's definitely the next logical step in the process. In fact, I mean, if you look back to the way things were before 2 years ago, so 2 years ago was the Windsor decision when the Supreme Court struck down part of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act that limited marriage to a man and a woman. The 12 states that had same-sex marriage before that, I mean, generally had evolved over time in the sense of they often banned discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation in housing, employment, public accommodations, would then get rid of bans on adoption, allow second parent adoption, and then would eventually get marriage. And now, since the Windsor decision, all these cases that have been coming down recently, and then the case that was decided today, all affect states that don't have those kinds of protections built in. You know, they're getting married first, and then you have to worry about the protections afterward, because what people kind of lose sight of is that this is a great decision. It's a huge victory. But for people who live in places that are very hostile to gays and lesbians, and there's still lots of places like that in the United States, what that means is that you can get married, and then when your employer finds out that you're in a same-sex marriage the next day, they can fire you, and there's nothing that can be done about it. And whether that, you know, impacts your decision at all to avail yourself of something that the Supreme Court is now saying your fundamental right under the Constitution, that's important, scary, all sorts of different things.
Sure, but at the same time, I mean, how can this type of discrimination now hold up legally? I mean,
it can hold up legally just because of the way things work in this country. That unless there's a prohibition against discrimination on these bases, I mean, there's nothing that, I mean, most employment relationships are at will in the United States, which means you can be fired for any reason or for no reason at all. It's only if there's some law there that says that you can't be fired. Because keep in mind what's happening. The decision that you see today is a decision about the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution binds what the states and the federal government can do. It doesn't bind what private individuals do. And so that's what we're talking about now. So, you know, a private employer firing their employee, the Constitution doesn't guarantee you any rights in that regard. It guarantees rights against the state, not against your private employer. And so you need laws that step in and say, well, yes, you might have generally at-will employment relationships in the United States, but you can't fire someone because of their race or their gender or their sexual orientation. So you need some kind of affirmative protection.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, our guest. University of Pittsburgh Law Professor Anthony Infante, 412-246-2002, to join the conversation. Let's go to John in Pittsburgh. John, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Hi, John.
Hello.
Yes, hello. You are on the air, sir. Welcome.
I think the issue is social stability for our society and for our children, not minor details of sexual orientation. I hadn't thought of the issue Mr. Infante brought up about discrimination simply on the basis of sexual orientation. And certainly that, too, would tend to destabilize relationships, marriages, and society. The real problem is all the forces that tend to destroy relationships, weaken marriage, and impair the ability to raise children properly.
So how do you view today's decision? Is it something that's
fundamental?
As a fundamental right.
Positive, it's a fundamental right and a positive move in the process of trying to create a stable society. And I think if you look at the statistics on sexual orientation, it's like the proverbial bell-shaped curve. You're going to get every shade. And instead of coming up with rigid black and white, you take what works.
Mm-hmm. Anthony Infante, your reaction to what John is saying here.
He's picking up on a lot of the themes from the majority opinion about, you know, stability and the effect. I mean, because they talk in the majority opinion, and this is very common from a lot of the opinions that have been coming out, including the Windsor case, but everything after that, about the effects of denying the right to marry to same-sex couples on the stability of the relationship, on the relationship, and on the families. Because, you know, there's no denying that there's many, many same-sex couples that have children. And, you know, denying the right to marry to same-sex couples impacts the children. It, you know, demeans the relationships, and it also, you know, impacts the benefits and makes life more burdensome. And so, I mean, that was clearly a factor in this opinion and in the other opinions that have been coming out for the past 2 years.
Let's go to John from St. Clair. John, you are on Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, we can.
Hi. Much of the opposition this argument, same-sex marriage argument, was based on this traditional idea of the idea of a traditional marriage, man and wife, which in turn had this sort of quasi-religious background, a Christian reading of that. Does the professor think that the nature, and I didn't read the decision, so, but I'm curious, do any of the dissents refer to that Christian reading or religious reading? And does the professor think that this decision will be a response to that effort to kind of read a religious or Christian interpretation of law. Is this in some way a repudiation or a narrowing of those effects? And I think it's a wonderful decision. But I'm just curious about implications of the decisions or the dissents for some future efforts to read this kind of interpretation or Christian or religious interpretation into these issues.
Yeah, and I, as I mentioned before, I haven't made it through all the dissents. I mean, the dissents, the skimming that I've done tend to focus a lot on, I mean, they do talk about the man-woman nature of marriage, its history, you know, long history, that kind of stuff. They tend to focus more on who's the decision maker. They seem to deplore quite a bit the fact the Supreme Court decided this rather than leaving it to the states to decide and letting voters decide it, that kind of stuff. But the majority opinion does talk a little bit near the very end about religion and the impact of this on people who, for religious reasons, disagree with same-sex marriage. And the court basically says, you know, look, you have a First Amendment right to believe what you want to believe and say what you want to say. And you're more than, you know, we're more than happy to let you go off and say, you know, stuff that's against same-sex marriage. And then there'll be people who, for religious reasons, will say stuff in favor of same-sex marriage. This opinion does not affect that at all, but that is not a reason to deny someone their fundamental right. You know, one person's First Amendment right to say what they believe is not a reason to curtail somebody else's rights under the law.
There are religious institutions and churches that support gay marriage and those that do not.
Right.
Does a church that does not, does this in any way force them to marry two people, two people of the same sex?
No, I don't believe so. I mean, the court mentions not a word about forcing anyone to marry. It came up in the arguments, in fact. They talked about, well, would, you know, so it didn't come up in the opinion, but in the arguments they had a couple months ago, you know, someone did bring up, well, would that mean that somebody would have to marry someone? And, you know, the answer was no. It's not going to force anyone to marry a couple, a same-sex couple, if they disagree with it. In fact, one of the justices talked about the fact that, well, you already have people who refuse, you know, so, you know, a rabbi won't marry, you know, someone who's not Jewish. And I mean, they brought up those kinds of examples that, you know, you're not going to force people.
Other exceptions already exist.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, it's been quite a day. And as you mentioned, Professor Infante, you're still looking through the dissenting opinion. So there's a lot to parse through here. But the takeaway for many is that this is, whether you are for or against gay marriage, this is certainly an historic, impactful day for citizens of the United States and for Pennsylvanians. And again, if you did not hear, as of this morning, same-sex marriage is now legal in all 50 states after the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that the Constitution requires that same-sex couples be allowed to marry regardless of where they live and that states may no longer prohibit gay marriage. We've been talking about this decision with University of Pittsburgh law professor Anthony Infante. Professor Infante, good to have you back. Thank you for joining us to share your views and insights.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on such an important day.
Coming up, we'll discuss the week's other big Supreme Court ruling upholding the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Chris Mamula, who covers health issues for the Pittsburgh Business Times, talks about what the ruling means for Pennsylvania on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. For the second time during his stint in the White House, the health care law that will define Barack Obama's presidency, the Affordable Care Act, has fended off a legal challenge from the right. The favorable 6-3 ruling handed down yesterday by the Supreme Court will give Obamacare a better chance of becoming a lasting part of America's social safety net. But how will this most recent and more assertive decision impact Pennsylvanians? I'm joined now in Studio A by Chris Mamula, who covers health issues for the Pittsburgh Business Times. Chris Mamula, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. My pleasure.
So what does the Supreme Court's decision mean for Pennsylvanians?
It is a great sigh of relief. There are, for Pennsylvanians, for 382,000 Pennsylvanians, it's a great, great day. It means that they'll continue to have tax credits that will be given by the Internal Revenue Service that will allow them to have affordable premiums for health care insurance.
And of those 382 Pennsylvanians that you mentioned, 382,000 Pennsylvanians that you mentioned, of those, how many, what percentage of them have never had health insurance before?
I don't know that number, but my guess is that Pennsylvania, before all of this, probably had in the neighborhood of 1 million people without insurance. So my guess is that quite a large majority of the 382,000 did not have insurance previously.
In your estimation, where has the Affordable Care Act thrived in its overall endeavor?
In providing basic health care insurance, just basic protection against bankruptcy. The number one reason for personal bankruptcy is health care bills. So medical bills drive people into bankruptcy. So here for the first time was something that would help avert that, help prevent that. That's where it's really had a big impact, or will have a big impact, I think.
Many of us thought this issue was settled before the Supreme Court ended up considering this not once but twice as a legal challenge. So is this issue now finally settled, or do you feel that the Republicans will mount a legislative challenge as they seem to be promising if a GOP president gets elected next year?
That's a hard question, Paul. It's tough to say what the Republicans will do. Are we done with challenges? My guess is not. The first one came the day after it was enacted, and I just think that this is going to continue. That from what I've heard today in news reports, it isn't as though the Republicans are going to roll over and accept it. I just don't think that's going to happen.
But what recourse do they have? I mean, this has been passed through Congress. It has been confirmed now and reaffirmed by the Supreme Court. What more can be done? How do you undo this? And what would happen if it was undone?
Good question. If it is undone, it means everyone who has health insurance as a result of the act with the subsidies is going to be in trouble. I mean, I don't know what you replace it with. And it seems like we've passed the tipping point. I would describe today's decision as a tipping point, that it's going to be harder to turn it around going forward. Each day that passes, each week that passes, as people get adjusted to the idea, become accustomed to having health insurance for the first time, and having the subsidies, the help to for the premiums, I think it's going to be much more difficult to turn around. But what would they use for a challenge? This challenge was based on four words in the Affordable Care Act, you know, of 2010, established by the state. So it's
whether the state can establish a health care exchange.
Perfect. Exactly. Right. Right. And in states like Pennsylvania and 26 other states, we used what they called a federally assisted exchange. We used a model or the hardware provided by the federal government. So the critics, the folks who challenged it said, no, that's not legal. That's a violation of the law. So at first blush, you'd say that's quite a reach. So it's hard to predict what the future challenges will be. But I think we can be assured that they will be there.
And the next question then would be, what exactly is the problem that the opposition has with Obamacare? And are there legitimate concerns here?
I think the first complaint would be that it's government overreach, that the government does not have a place where the free market could operate well. So it's like government interference in a space that is taken care of by the free market currently. I think that would be the argument. You could say, though, with the number of people who did not have insurance, that the free market solution, there is lots of evidence showing that it was not working, that there was some need for a legislative solution.
Why is this act more controversial than most?
Wow. That's a hard one. I think it's because just of the size of the program, how big it is, how many people are affected. It's the biggest piece of healthcare-related legislation since the 1960s, the biggest one in our generation. I think it's the size of it that has drawn so much attention and opposition.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Chris Mamula of the Pittsburgh Business Times, parsing through yesterday's favorable Supreme Court ruling on Obamacare. What are the ways, Chris, that this law can be improved? What do you hear people saying? What are the critics saying? And now that we've gotten to this point, can they tweak it? And if they do, how logically will they go about that?
The the Achilles heel of the law, in my view, is the deductibles that the insured have to pay. And it's something you don't even hear much about. But all of these individual plans come with very high deductibles. That is the amount of money that the member has to pay before the insurance kicks in. And sometimes, you know, a deductible of $6,000, of $10,000, $13,000 is not unusual in these plans. And so if someone is receiving a subsidy that helps them with a premium, that's a good thing. But the other side of that is if you have to use it, then you have to come up with that money up front. And that is a burden for people who have the insurance, but it's also a burden for hospitals. Hospitals get stuck with that.
So, the hospitals get stuck with it because people can't pay and the hospitals are not going to turn them away?
Exactly.
So what can be done about that? I mean, who can step in and, you know, can the government, I mean, God forbid, the government step in and maybe help to mitigate some of that cost, but can you see, if not someone from the Obama administration, maybe someone in Congress looking at this and saying, we have to come up with some kind of, you know, as long as they've created a health insurance exchange and it's been found to be kosher by the Supreme Court, can they then come up with a way to help people who have limited economic means to bridge that gap?
You would think so, Paul. You would think there would be a legislative solution of some kind that would address that, and it was not addressed in the original law. It wasn't about price controls. The original law wasn't about price controls. So companion legislation that would address that somehow, put caps on it perhaps, that's one way to do it. But as it is, those bills are big. That's a lot of money to have to come up with out of pocket.
For sure. And let's backtrack here a little bit. When you say that that this was not why the law was created, then why was it created? Let's remind ourselves of that.
Sure. It was because that so many people had no insurance whatsoever. And I think that was what drove it, is the lack of insurance. And the cost end of it was not really built into it. I think it was maybe an expectation that it would have that the law would have that, but in the end it didn't. There are no measures or tools or anything in there to do that.
And was that because of the compromises and the fact that this law in its original form and in the way that the designers of it had intended for it to be got so watered down, there were so many compromises to the point where okay, you've got the insurance, but you know, here's all of the fine print that tells you, you know, you have to assume this cost and that cost, et cetera, et cetera.
I think it was a matter of practicality. What can we get through? What can we reasonably expect to pass? That look at the law as it is. I don't know how many thousands of pages it was, just for what we have to tackle more global kinds of issues, I think, would have been something altogether too unwieldy. It was enough of a problem to get this passed as it is. And it may well have been because of a compromise, that compromises along the way where they tweak this and tweak that.
And to be fair, it's not just the conservatives that are critical of this. There's also liberals or libertarians, and there are people like Ralph Nader advocated for single payer.
Yes, absolutely. And there's some good sense, good reasons for that. And one is cost. That the Medicare, if you look at the cost, the government's cost of running the Medicare system, it is a fraction of the cost of running of a commercial health plan, because you don't have the margin built into it. Many insurers, Highmark, UPMC Health Plan in the Pittsburgh area, probably 10 cents of every dollar goes to profit, basically. For Medicare, that number is far, far smaller, a few cents. I think it's a fraction of that.
Has the overall attitude towards Obamacare changed even grudgingly now that we've had it for, what's it been, 5 years or so now?
We've had it for 5 years, but we're only now seeing it really get rolling as far as that goes. And if you've seen the polls early on, it was almost unanimous. People were furious about it and didn't understand it, didn't want anything to do with it. But as time has gone on, as people become more familiar with it and get enrolled and get the insurance, I think you're seeing a comfort level. I heard a poll even today that there's a shift in public opinion about this, a greater acceptance than there has been. And I think I would expect that to increase.
Okay, so gut check time. Chris Mamula, do you feel the Affordable Care Act is here to stay?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that. Yeah, it's not to uproot it at this point would be just, well, today's the decision by the Supreme Court could have done exactly that. There would have been chaos. And I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's too much.
What do you read into the fact that the Supreme Court 3 years ago, it was a very narrow ruling, 5-4. Today was 6-3. So is that even a greater affirmation?
I think it's a reflect today's the ruling is more the 6-3 ruling was more of a reflection of how much of a stretch the challenge was, and the challenge was those four words, and I felt it was really reaching in a sense. You know, it's almost very, you know, any scrap that we can find to try to throw enough at the wall and maybe something will stick. It just is. And I think it was more of a reach even than the first decision. So
what does this mean for President Obama's legacy?
There's no question it'll be a very big part of his legacy. Yeah, that's here. The law is here to stay. The more time that passes, the more people enrolled, the more people that get at the idea of what it's like to have health insurance, to have regular health care, regular checkups. So many preventive services that are covered, that are paid for. It's here to stay, and it's certainly a part of his legacy, I would think.
And what do you suppose Governor Wolf is thinking today? You know, he's the guy that basically dismantled Corbett Care, if you will, and said, no, we're going to do it the way the Affordable Care Act was written, the way it was intended to be. So is there in that part of Harrisburg, is there maybe a little bit of rejoicing going on?
Oh, there's no question about that there. Yeah, there is. And the governor announced that he was developing contingency plans. Had the Supreme Court ruled against the Obama administration, it would have blown up the Affordable Care Act as we know it. Completely.
And he had to come up with those contingency plans.
He had to come up with contingency plans. And he was smart. He made an application to Medicare and said, we want to start our own exchange just in case. We want to be ready. We want to have subsidies available. We want these to continue. And we have to be ready for this. I don't know what kind of opposition he would have faced in the legislature to get that through. But at least he took the steps that he did, and he was in that direction. And today he said, with this decision, it doesn't matter if we have a federally assisted health care exchange or a state-based exchange. We're dropping that effort. We're not going to move forward with it.
Chris Mamula of the Pittsburgh Business Times joining us to talk about yesterday's favorable Supreme Court ruling on Obamacare. Thanks, Chris.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's been said many times that the Steel City is traditionally a shot and beer town, and the beer is usually an Iron City, a Rolling Rock, or you could have a Duke Duquesne, if you can remember that ad campaign. But today there are so many more choices with the increased popularity of craft beers and brew pubs. Joining us to discuss this phenomenon is Hal B. Klein, Pittsburgh Magazine food columnist. Hal, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on again.
And Mark Brewer, the perfectly named author and illustrator of the book Brewology. Mark Brewer, good to have you on Essential Pittsburgh.
And thank you very much. Appreciate it.
First, Hal B. Klein, what is a brew pub and how is it different from the old-fashioned corner bar?
So a brew pub is a place, or a tap room, is a place where a brewery is selling only beer that they've brewed. And what's amazing about Pittsburgh is that since 2011, there have been over 20 that have opened up. Which is really kind of phenomenal.
So don't go in there and ask for a Pabst Blue Ribbon.
No, don't go in there and ask for a Pabst Blue Ribbon.
What are some of the brew pubs out there, and what makes them special?
There are a bunch, and I think what makes it so interesting is that they're all in different styles and specialties. And so one of the hardest parts of writing the story was actually having to limit it to just 7 in the callouts. And I really wanted to make sure that we had a great amount of geography. So Drylog in Millvale, Brew Gentleman all the way over in Braddock. There are a ton in Lawrenceville. And so there were some great ones that I couldn't even put in, like Grist House, which is also in Millvale. I see you're wearing a Roundabout Brewery shirt, which is in Lawrenceville.
Mark is.
And I mean, you can even, if you're in Lawrenceville, you could even start up at Hop Farm Brewing, walk to Full Pint, walk to Roundabout Brewery, cross the river, go to Drylog, go to Grist House. It's amazing.
Mark Brewer, you took the opportunity to document the culture of beer with your book, Brewology. How did this come about?
Started brewing beer 20 years ago. And these interesting words kept popping up: hops, malt, IPA. So I wrote them all down in a book that I would come back to later. A lot of cartoonists, illustrators have little notebooks they keep, and they have ideas in them, and they'll get back to them later because they're too busy. So believe it or not, it took me 17, 20 some years to come back to this idea. And I thought, you know, I need to document this stuff myself, because it's obviously the craft beer movement is just it's just going crazy, and I wanted to learn more about beer, so I put it all in a book. And I've been illustrating for 20 years, so I illustrated these some of the more funny ones, and there you have it. And people dig it so far.
Yeah, and you decided to take a really lighthearted approach here too.
Yeah.
For example, you have people always talk about, when, pouring a beer and the head on the beer,
right.
and talk about how you address that in your book.
Yeah. So, something for I just drew a picture of a guy with a very large afro type of hair. And it's just little images like that. Hops, with bunnies hopping all over the place, and toasted malt with a piece of bread on a dark beer, and so.
And the dude with this is the picture, right?
This one's foamy head.
Foamy head.
Yeah.
And the guy looks like,
a hippie. Yeah.
Well, there's a little John Lennon going
a little
on
bit.
The glasses, a little Elton John
bit there.
Happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that one.
But it's good. If people will enjoy the illustrations in this book. And as far as the trend of, the brew pubs, Hal, why is it so popular now? Why? Years ago, you'd go into, people had their same beer they'd order every day, and now it's so much different. What has changed? Why has it changed?
Well, I think it's a couple of reasons. I think you're seeing that with a lot of different things. With food, people are becoming more adventurous. With spirits, people are becoming more adventurous. And with beer, what I love the most about brewers is there are just these amazing, creative, scientifically minded people, and they have access now to better ingredients and are able to experiment and play with style. And consumers are just so excited to go and try all these different styles and just drink it up. And yeah, I think it's a really exciting time for it. And once you have a really good craft beer, it's really hard to go back.
Yeah, absolutely.
To a beer that's mass produced that has no flavor. People like flavor.
Well, it's an interesting piece that you've written about the craft beer culture in Pittsburgh. It made the cover of the most recent Pittsburgh magazine, the July 2015 edition. You can check out Hal B. Klein's piece, which is also featuring some wonderful photographs, and also the book Brewology by Mark Brewer, and he illustrated the book, and there are some wonderful illustrations in there to check out. Again, Brewology by Mark Brewer. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us to talk about something we just can't talk enough about on this program, and that's beer.
Thanks.
Thanks, Bob.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.FM or as a podcast in iTunes. Until Monday, I'm Paul Guggenheimer saying have a great weekend.